Okay, we are going to start. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our panel, especially welcome also to our speakers. Next to me, Christian von Borries, Michael Dieber, Severin Dussolier, Simon Jühl, Gordon Duggan, and to my left, Nicolas Malévy. My name is Cornelia Solfrank, and I will be hosting this session, which stands under the big headline, Art and Copyright. The title of this panel is Freedom of Art Limited? We will discuss the question if copyright does not just support artists, but also puts up limits to the work of artists, to freedom of art. This would be especially the case for artistic strategies which are based on the reworking of pre-existing material, namely aesthetic strategies like collage, montage, remixing, sampling, etc., all kinds of artistic appropriation. Before I will introduce you to the speakers and we will start the discussion, I would like to ask Nicolas Malévy to give a brief report of the workshop we had yesterday, also under the headline Art and Copyright. It took place at Tesla. The workshop had been organized by Nicolas and myself, and there were about 25 people participating. Nicolas is an artist and a programmer living in Brussels, where he is part of an organization called Constant, which is a feminist organization busy with free software and other interesting things. Okay, Nicolas, please, a short report from the workshop.
Thank you, Cornelia. Yesterday, a group of artists, programmers, and theoreticians met for an exchange of experience within a workshop situation. The program of the day included a general discussion about terminology. It addressed questions of authorship. It discussed the role of free tools as better instruments for artistic creation and as mediator between the public and an aesthetic experience. It tried to understand how the practices and the licenses mutually define and influence one another. And finally, demonstrated a new model of open publishing, as well as an exploration of free tools in design and publishing during a final printing party. Making a summary of a day so full of ideas is a difficult task. It will therefore be partial and subjective. I must thank Saul Albert to have taken the time to help me doing it. Cornelia introduced the workshop, insisting on the fact that all the terminology we were using to speak about open and free culture was unstable and needed permanent redefinition. Perhaps the term author was the one to be recontextualized the most yesterday. As we know, free and open licenses are based upon copyright author rights. It therefore means that even in a free culture, the notion of author plays a key role. As Laurence Rassel put it, it is a location from where we can strategically operate. Eberhard Hortland listed four reasons why he thought the author wouldn't die. The first of these reasons is economic. As long as artists would make money with copyright. The second, he says, is political. Attributing a creation to an individual makes him or her responsible for this creation. The third is erotic. Authorship may give to anyone its 15 minutes of sexiness. The fourth is a semantic reason. By attributing the same author to different creations, we can trace an evolution, a genealogy. Whether these reasons are still valid in the present context was one of the main issues discussed. Gregor Petersens emphasized the difference between object-based and flow-based value systems, the latter tending to valuable relationships in a network. If the concept of authorship applies easily to the ownership of an object, it tends to be more difficult to apply to a set of relationships. Saul Albert gave an overview of how it might be possible to make a living without making property and achieving some form of independence from that network by doing away with copyright copyleft and diversifying service-based markets for cultural practices. Starting from her personal experience, Inke Arms proposed a reality check. What happens when reappropriation comes from above, when institutions hack artists or curators? Can you afford to use the law against the institution with which you will have to work later? Can you sue the gallery on which you depend? Bite the hand that feeds you? How useful is the system of author's rights if you depend so strictly to one source of revenue? Artists need free tools, said Gisle Freusland and Meiter Steiner, to shape the tools they need to avoid the homogenization of the artistic production. Artists need to take part in their conception, testing, development. If Jacob Lillemoos tried to emphasize that tools were also more than devices to assist the production of an artwork, it looked yesterday that it was the primary need to be fulfilled. Harrison and Pierre Heugebart, later in the day, reinforced this line of thought, showing how the relationship between tools and the political context, in their case the monopoly of Adobe over the graphic designer's toolbox, created the necessity for the creators to re-harness their means of production. Licenses are not enough to provide the conditions for a free culture. They rely on context and practices. Olivier Schulbaum and Ignacio Garcia explain how they used free licenses in their projects as a moment of self-reflection that helps the participants understand the collective organization of a project. Most participants in the workshop yesterday considered licenses as ethic statements, an invitation. This is what I would like you to do with my work. Rather than legal documents they didn't want to use in court. It was indeed reassuring to see that cultural and artistic projects wouldn't behave like little nation states using the threat of litigation to enforce their social agreements. But on the other hand, then, why to use a license to express such ethical values? The discussion took a very depressive turn while coming to the subject of the collecting societies and the thousand ways artists can be sued for borrowing, using, sampling materials. Once again, the question wasn't, is the law fair enough, but, well, who can afford the lawyer? Olivier Schulbaum stated that the free licenses were busy solving only the last bit of the problem, the consumption part. From her experience with the selection of movies released under Creative Commons, Michael Richter explained ways filmmakers found money to support the creation of their movies via advertising, fundraising, pre-orders. If these attempts were still exceptions, they suggest that new models for funding may arise. Simon Worthington's presentation of the print-based publication service ByMute reinforced this idea. The print-on-demand of Mutes goes toward a network of collaborating remixers and spinners augmented by smart open-source software tools. In case of success, their business model would be some kind of proof of concept on a larger than subsistence scale. Regularly during these discussions, the model of free and open source software versus collaboration-based art production have been compared. Felix Stalder stressed the point that in free software projects, we could see hierarchies arise. They are accepted by developers since the quality of code and coders is not too difficult to assert. In the case of artists, it is nearly impossible to agree on what is the quality of a good artist or a good art project. This makes it difficult for art projects to function similarly to collaborative projects in software. It favors, nevertheless, free transformative projects where each transformation leads to a new piece. The fear of artists of being lost in a collaborative project has often been evoked. Simon Newell remarked, on the contrary, that in the free software world, participating to a project was a way to be visible, to put one's code in circulation under his or her own name, rather than under the name of one's agency or corporation. From these discussions, it is difficult to extract a list of recommendations, a blueprint, or a clear conclusion. One must nevertheless recognize the extraordinary activity of people active in the field, controversially called free culture, and accept that for some time we will still have to live in the company of questions rather than certainties. This is why, as the next step of the workshop, a manifesto of open questions is proposed to all people interested in joining the debate, to share your favorite questions about free and open licenses, you can join us on the mailing list was-workshop@sandwares.org. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Nicolas, for this really detailed and rich report. So we jump into our panel discussion, and we start with a very practical example of what artists are doing with other artists' work, and also showing a little bit what kind of trouble that might arise from that. I would like to introduce Christian von Borries and Michael Weber next to me. Christian von Borries is a musician, a conductor, composer, and a producer. In 1998, he started his cycle of concerts under the label Musikmissbrauch, Abuse of Music. In this series, Borries focuses on personal connotations and various settings of the reception of music. And in 2003, he started a concert series named Psychogeography that added a fourth dimension, which is music, to buildings and spaces. Amongst the commissions he has got was Remix Beethoven at the Luzern Festival, as well as the production of Replay Debussy, which he realized for Universal Music. And just last week, we missed the pleasure to attend his interpretation of the Tannhäuser opera of Richard Wagner at the Weimar Music Festival. His most recent project is called Sound Alike, which he's doing together with Michael Eber. And something I would also like to mention, last but not least, Christian sometimes stresses that he is also a member of the GEMA, and GEMA is a German collecting society. And I guess he's stressing this not because he's just a regular member, but it is part of his work to question collecting societies and the way they understand authorship and sometimes freedom of art also. So next is Michael Eber. He's collaborating with Christian on the project Sound Alike, as I said, where he does the computer programming. Michael was originally a classical pianist trained at the Royal Academy in London. He's interested in the process of musical interpretation in a broader sense, leading to a differentiated understanding of a piece of art and its authorship. In the course of time, his artistic focus had shifted from the traditional instrument towards electronic music and computer programming, and he is now a passionate supporter of the Linux audio world and has been reflecting his musical and aesthetic views in numerous radio features and essays. And I hand you over the microphone, and we are excited to hear more about your project.
Hello, everybody. So you're sitting in front of two classical musicians, which might be unusual, because first of all, when you study classical music, you have an instrument, an analog instrument, and how you learn to be concerned about music is you take your score, and it might be a very well edited modern score of an old piece, and you are told to sit in a corner with your score and to find by yourself a way how to deal with that, and then find out a way to perform that. The questionable thing about this is that on one hand you are confronted with music that has been used in many different ways. On the other hand, there are a lot of recordings out there. So you are told recordings is something you should not be too much concerned about. Just take the score. That's the original. That's the thing, the only thing you have to be concerned about. That is what we both experienced. And when we met, we were talking about that a lot. For me, it turned out that I was always much more interested in recordings and in the history of recording the 20th century, which is obviously in the first half of the 20th century, mostly a history of recording of classical music, which is a big part of the history of reception of music in general. So when you listen to a recording from the early 20th century compared to a recording 100 years later, you not only hear different kind of a different way to make music, but also you hear surface noises in the old recordings. You hear a different way of frequency range depending on the recording techniques. All that is, in my opinion and my experience, becoming an information about what is music from the past. Another example: when you talk about music of the 19th century. How it was used in the 20th century. That's a problem that I always came across working with other classical musicians as a conductor with orchestras. For example, in this Tannhäuser project on the Wartburg Castle, we used a piece by Franz Liszt, also a 19th century composer, and the piece was used in the Third Reich as the introductory music for the German army reports from the front line. And I told the orchestra, please play it in the way that it sounds like an old recording. And they hated me for that. And they didn't want to draw a connection of use and abuse of music. I'm saying all this because there's one question behind it that interests me most. And that is the question, where is the work of art? Where is it? What is it? In which state of appearance is it occurring to us? Is it the score? Is it the printed music? What is the printed music compared to the piece of music? Is it maybe the recording? Is it maybe a totally different thought? Not worth even to talk about recordings, about scores, about the history of the piece, since we all, each of us here, would see and listen to a piece of music anyway in a different way. So that's a thought of Roland Barthes and Foucault, and maybe already starting with Nietzsche and those people who said the birth of the listener started with the death of the composer in a translated way. So those are questions that led to a different approach of music, and the approach of music is rather not playing the piece of music, but thinking about music, and maybe a piece of music occurs out of that, that is thinking about a piece of music, which is something that's very unusual. It might be more usual in electronic music, in pop music, where you have much more of appropriation, one could say, cover versions, who are sometimes much more famous than original pieces, so that the borders between original second version, adaption, arrangement, which I would all consume under the term interpretations in the broadest sense, that's much more weakened, which is a big advantage of that type of music. In classical music, the way you have to see things is very strict. So when we talk about music that is where the composer is dead more than 70 years, which happened last year with Alban Berg, this is how far we are, where we don't have a problem to use music and to put it in a different, to present it in a different way than it might have been meant by the originator. We don't have a problem. When we talk about more contemporary music, we might get into problems. And so the question we asked ourselves was, since we have the history of recorded music, which, by the way, is a book that has not been written yet, we were thinking, how about if a piece of music would be played in the way how it is recorded? How could we make a live performance of a recording? And I'm not talking about playing a record on stage. That's that might also be something that's interesting, referring to the history of recorded music. But how could we talk, how could we see the, how could we regain the aura of a live played music, of music that originally was meant to be played live? But maybe it only exists in a recording, let's say film music. So what we did was we tried to find a way to regain this property. And we want now to play an example of what we found out to do. So what you will hear now is 1.5 minutes of music played live by a string orchestra of 30 musicians.
So I heard a short excerpt of the concert we did last Saturday from the Wartburg in Eisenach, a very historical German place. And you could hear that this musical is a real referential music. I mean, many of you might have recognized the piece. I'm not sure, but so this is a very referential thing to do, to apply to a piece of music. So I want to explain to you now a little bit what was happening. Basically, what we do is to read a recording into the computer, which and the music is being analyzed, and then you can set up what kind of instrumentation you want to use and in which range the single instruments should play this thing. Which comes out as a very kind of pointillistic, I mean, like the painter's pointillistic picture of the music, which was there before as a kind of analog recording. And for us, it was very interesting because, I mean, it's absolutely impossible to get, for example, or have the approach to play something in or use a recording and get the score, which was the original of the recording, to get this out. Some institutions like the French IRCAM, a big institution for electronic music, or the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany, are working on these kind of things, I mean, to really get the proper score out of the recording. But they are talking about the holy grail of audio programming. This is not very interesting for us. For us, it's especially interesting this kind of blurriness this recording does. I mean, that you're not sure, is it really the piece you heard? And what new qualities do you get? And especially by playing this with an orchestra, so the program in the end would put out a complete full score and all the voices for the single musicians. And especially having it played by an orchestra adds much even to the simulations we're doing with MIDI, just for our own control and how to design the score, and makes a very different impression or expression of the music and a different quality than it would be just being played by a computer. Another thing is the operatic moment of a concert. I mean, everybody knows that it's quite different to listen to music in a concert environment or a stage environment or at home or in your car through a recording equipment or audio equipment. And that's this very special thing about it. I mean, that we have to quantize all this music in a fixed beat. Let's say, I mean, in this case, I think it was 120 beats per minute, and the shortest notes were 16th note. So the conductor would conduct a complete different speed than the one you're listening to, because the music just doesn't follow this because it was a recording and it's not fit into this quantization scheme. But in the end, the basic question we have is this the piece of music we put in? Is it an own work, which even the German GEMA says it is, but how to deal with it? Maybe you can take over a little bit more about the question of the copyright and GEMA thing.
So the situation towards the GEMA or towards those institutions, we are both, we joined the GEMA to find out how we can deal with those institutions and how they would consider that. The GEMA, which is an institution that is led by its members, they only follow, as they say themselves, the proposals and the sort of internal laws of their members. And when you become a member, you can start try change that, which is, as it turns out, is almost impossible. So we send in those scores. As long as they see the score, it's not a problem. As soon as there's a review that refers to Morricone, in this case, they will say, okay, this is not allowed. You have to ask the intellectual property holder of Morricone, which probably is an Italian publisher or something like that. You have to ask them if this is possible, what you do beforehand. And we even had a more prominent example when I wanted to use a part of a piece of Karlheinz Stockhausen, and someone else said that in an interview immediately that I received a letter by the guy saying, I'm not allowing you to do that. That's actually the crucial point. One has to ask those people beforehand. It's not the reality that you can use whatever you want to and you pay those people off for, let's say, the amount of time within your own piece, which would be totally understandable, and then you can do with it what you want. No, you have to ask them beforehand, so there's a censorship built in. That's the case with the GEMA, that's the case with all the original intellectual property holders. That's the big problem, because when I think of what we are doing, seeing ourselves as interpreters, and an interpreter is always someone who's appropriating things, because in music and theater and film, you have to play the things to so that they materialize. the score is not the music. The book is with the printed theater piece is not the theater piece. So you always have the interpreter in between, and you have to ask yourself, so what is the interpreter actually? Is the interpreter that's just playing the music? He might play one piece in half the tempo than the other one. Is it still the same piece? He might do it in a different instrumentation. Is it still the same piece? From which moment on is it another piece? Let's say we give a very difficult piece of contemporary music to a very bad group of musicians that can't play the piece. Is it still the piece? They might have the music on their stands. Is it still the piece? From which moment on is it not the piece? You see, with those examples, you can't draw a line, really. There is no line. It's a gray zone, the whole thing, which makes the question why you have to ask for permission beforehand. Totally unexplainable, but that's the reality we are facing. The GEMA always says, this is your piece of art, that's not the problem, but you have to ask beforehand. So with another piece that we did together that included a lot of other pieces, it's a pending process. They say we have to ask all the original copyright holders. We don't know what to do.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to clarify that we are asked to ask the original copyright holders, because you didn't mention that. We don't have to ask GEMA. They try to keep out of the whole context. They are just not doing anything for us. And they ask us, they want us to ask the original copyright holders first to get permission.
Okay, last sentence. Last sentence. The way how we deal with music that exists already is a way that is dealt with music during centuries. It's an typical Western European way to deal with culture, to take culture as a source for new things. There's nothing new, really, about this process. The things that changed in the last, let's say, 50 years is the laws that are connected to that, and that has to do with media and also the way how big companies, record companies, copyright holders, how they think they can make money out of that. So it's rather them who are going to change the culture. There's actually a very interesting interview on the Public Enemy website where they say hip-hop changed its face completely since the beginning, because nobody can afford samples anymore, so they have to invent all that themselves. That's a totally different kind of music that came from a different background. They face the same problem. So in a way, you can say worldwide, music is changing because of those laws, and we have to be very much aware of that. Thank you.
And we are claiming that the referential quality of music has always been there.
One question, Chris. I have one question to Christian. I have a CD of your music, Wagner Complex, which is licensed under Creative Commons. How does this go together with GEMA?
It's not so easy to get into GEMA, and I had just sent away the letter, and that was just 2 years ago when I heard the first time about Creative Commons, and that was the last days of where we printed the booklet and the sleeve for the CD. So I put that on before I signed with the GEMA. It was just a couple of days earlier. But in a way it doesn't matter. They are not going to sue you anyway. It's just that they don't care about you, as long as it's not big enough.
Okay, this was an example of artists which I selected, or we selected, because you're not just doing what you're doing, but you're very conscious about what you're doing, the framework, the conditions under which you're working, and the notions of authorship, originality, etc., is also something you work about theoretically. So that's, I think, is really interesting. And I would like to end this first contribution with a remark, because I have the impression that you are not really typical victims of the copyright regime. I more have the impression that you really enjoy challenging it and exploring with the limits and the borders, also challenging GEMA and playing around. For example, I know this exchange you had with Stockhausen, which you also published later, where you ask him how does he know Stockhausen that he is the author of this piece and not you, etc. So you had all this exchange, you published it, and I really have the feeling you enjoy doing that. It's part of your work. Wouldn't it be boring for you if everything would be under free license?
Well, the way how I started, there's a German saying, you can say, das Kind mit dem Bade ausschütten. It sort of came to me. It wasn't really a choice. Now that things became more complicated in the way how we use music, there's something to enjoy about it, but it also can happen any moment. And I think it has to do with the fame or also the money that's involved, things might become more complicated. As long as you get money from the state and you can do those things, which is possible in Germany, that's good. But who knows what the future brings? In the moment, that's okay.
And GEMA is saying, as long as we don't do any recordings with the stuff, it's okay. I mean, the first problem we are facing and the first time we are going to be a victim is when we start to do recordings.
And we will do that.
Okay, we are looking forward to that. We will follow that. The next speaker, thank you for your contribution. The next speaker is Séverine Dussolier. She will tell us more about the possibilities which are there within existing copyright law and how artists could make use of them. Séverine Dussolier is doctor in law. She's currently professor at the University of Namur in Belgium, where she's teaching intellectual property, copyright, art law, and IT law. And I got to know Séverine through her involvement with Creative Commons, where she is the project leader for Belgium. She carried out the porting of the CC licenses into Belgian law. Please, Séverine.
Thank you. As the lawyer in the panel, I should say that I'm not here to defend the law as a system or anything. I would be the first to say that for me, law is sometimes, often even, a bit inconsistent, and that it sometimes is completely disconnected from the reality. And as a lawyer, I'm trying to use the law to make change the law so this discrepancy is reduced as much as possible. And since I'm really I'm really working in copyright law, in legal issues of artistic creation. This issue of artistic appropriation has been made me angry for many years. So I would like to explain to you what are the legal difficulties of artistic appropriation. You know most of them, and also try to find with you some strategies. We just heard one strategy from the artistic field, and I would like to explore some legal strategy that we could develop to make that law change so it could accommodate a bit more practices of appropriation. So, particularly for the art appropriation, the law seems to be completely disconnected from reality. And it comes from an historical reason, I think. The historical reason being that at the time when copyright law was born, there was a strong focus on the subject, politically, philosophically, everything. And so the emphasis in copyright law is on the authorship, is on the author. And this emphasis, could have been another choice, but it was a choice at the time. For instance, it's not the same model in patent law, where patent law protects the process of innovation. Copyright protects the author and the creation of the author, so it's a bit different. And the fact that the author is really the center of the legal protection in copyright draws a very strict line between what is considered as an original work created by the author, and with a copy. And any copy of this original work is normally considered as an infringement of the copyright in the original. So this line is really, really strong in copyright, even though in the last 50 years there have been a lot of things going on outside of the law to blur that line. But in the legal system, that line has not been blurred much, and it stays very strongly. And this is the main reason why copyright infringement is always a threat when you are doing artistic appropriation. So there are some principles in copyright law that can help artists to create, to make artistic appropriation, but they are not very easy to develop and to use. The first principle is very easy. It's the fact that copyright protects only the expressions, the form of a work, and not the idea, the concept, the style of a work. So it's a very basic line in copyright. So that means that artists are free to imitate a style, to use an idea, to rework a concept in a work and everything. So that means, for instance, that Cindy Sherman can photograph herself in the style of the Hollywood movies of the 50s. She doesn't make any copyright infringement in the films of those of the 50s. So there's no problem. But you will say to me, okay, but it's a minimal part of artistic appropriation. And I agree with you. In most of the case, artists takes the work, the expression of the work, the form of the work, and not only the idea or the concept of the work. So it doesn't help us much. So we have to look for something else. There are other things in copyright law, in any copyright law in the world, is that the copyright is not unlimited. It has some limitation that we call the copyright exception. So in some cases, the law says that in some circumstances that the law defines very strictly, maybe exceedingly strictly, in some cases, the use of a work will not be a copyright infringement. It will be allowed, for instance, because there is another interest that is at stake. There is a public interest of education, for instance, and things like that. And in those lists of copyright exception, we can find some cases that could apply to art appropriation. Those exceptions, the problem with those exceptions is that they are very different from one country to another. For instance, in the United States, they know very roughly explained, there are no a very big exception that is called the fair use. And it's something that is not very well defined, but is defined in case of a litigation. So it's good because it's not very defined, but at the same time it's bad because you have to go to litigation to know exactly if you are infringing or not. So it's a big problem. I won't talk about the US fair use because we won't have much time. So I will focus on the exceptions as we know them in Europe. But even in Europe, from one country to another, there are different types of exceptions. The first exception that might be relevant for artistic appropriation is what we call the quotation, the right of quotation. This exception should exist in all copyright laws in the world because it's a mandatory exception, because it was in the Berne Convention that is a sort of umbrella international treaties in copyright. So that exception should appear in all legislation. The problem with quotation, because in artistic appropriation, in a way you quote another work, you use another work, you integrate it in your work. But the problem with that quotation, there are several problems. The first problem is that in some countries it says that quotation has to be short. So for instance, you can take some seconds of music, you can take some lines of a text. It's not true in all countries. In Belgium, for instance, the quotation shouldn't be short. So it's a problem for artistic appropriation. The other problem is that the quotation is allowed only where it is made for the purpose of criticism, review, teaching, or research. And case law has the tendency to interpret very strictly the notion of criticism or review. And I'm not sure, there is not so much case law, but I'm not sure that it could apply to art appropriation, that judge could see a work that is using an existing work to criticize it, to recontextualize it as a criticism. So it should be tried at least in courts. And there is also the problem that of the notion of quotation itself. Because when you say quotation, you mean that you refer to another work to illustrate your own point of view. And it's most of the case, it's not what the appropriation works are about. They are not referring to another work. They are using the other works as the primary material for their own creation. So there is not this relationship of illustration, of reference. So it's a bit difficult to use that exception, but we should try, and we should at least try to extend the boundaries of that exception. Another exception that I think might be very useful, but a lot of people just say no, it's not the case, is the parody exception. So in many European countries, you have the law provides that you are allowed to make a parody of a work. We have a European directive on that says that you can make a parody, a caricature, I don't know how it's pronounced in English, or a pastiche. Those are the terms, those terms come from the French law. And it exists in some country. To my knowledge, it was never applied to art appropriation. And I personally think that this exception of parody could play a bigger role in art appropriation if we are willing to adopt a broader meaning of what a parody is. The problem of parody in most of the country is that parody is allowed when you are doing it fairly or taking into account the loi du genre, as they say in French. And with this notion of fair practice of the loi du genre, they mean that you can make a parody to make people laugh. So parody is for laughing and not for anything else. So you have this strong link between parody and laughing, and I think that we should maybe skip that relationship and go and see somewhere else in parody. And for that, I looked into common sense of parody and about some writings about what is parody in history. And it wasn't always to make the audience laugh. And most of the time, it was very serious. It was very political. There are some writings about what is a parody, what from what Greek word came the word parody, and it was used in Greek theater, and it was very political and very serious. I looked also at the writings of, not really in copyright law, but in gender theory, of the writings of Judith Butler. And Judith Butler is using a very, she's thinking a lot about the meaning of parody, and she used the parody as something that is there to counteract the predominant meaning and hegemonic meaning of our culture and to pervert it, to subvert it, so we are closer to art appropriation there. And I also found another idea is that in the law they talk about parody, caricature, and pastiche. And for me, I think we should try something. Parody would be made for laughing. Caricature, I don't know really what it is, but pastiche could be a serious parody. So a parody without laughing. And I found a quotation of Frederick Jameson in Postmodernism and Consumer Society, where he says that pastiche is like parody, the imitation of a peculiar or unique style, the wearing of a stylistic mask, but it is a neutral practice of mimicry, without parody's ulterior motive, without a satirical impulse, without laughter, without that still latent feeling that there exists something normal compared to which what is being imitated is rather comic. Pastiche is a blank parody, a parody that has lost its humor. So I think that we should try as lawyer to put some weight in that notion of pastiche and to say, okay, parody is for humor. We agree with the existing case law. But we still have the pastiche. And pastiche is not for humor. It can be for any reason. It can be to critic. It can be to make a creative statement. It can be to create simply. So we could maybe try to link art appropriation with the pastiche. Maybe I'm a bit naive, but it's what I like to do. There is, if I still have 1 minute or 2 minutes. Outside of the exceptions and outside of copyright law, we should also try to look to fundamental rights and freedoms. So it's true that copyright system is a closed system, but it's not that close because we have what is prevailing is the fundamental rights. For instance, the fundamental right of expression, the fundamental freedom of art. Those two freedoms are recognized in many international texts, and for instance, the freedom of art, of artistic creation, that is that requires that the artist can enjoy sufficient freedom to create, is a freedom that is recognized in the European Charter of Fundamental Rights, that is included in the European Constitution, European Union Constitution. So it's very important right that hasn't been so much used in case law. The problem when arguing that, for instance, if you are sued for copyright infringement, that the application of copyright law would be contrary to your freedom to create, to your freedom of expression, is that that sort of reasoning hasn't been accepted that much by courts, because they said normally freedom of exception are not unlimited. You can limit freedom of expression, you can limit freedom of the art, but the condition to limit that is that the limitation should be justified and should be proportional. So if you are sued for copyright infringement, you can try to argue that the limitation to your freedom that the copyright impose on you is unjustified and disproportionate. It has been a successful defense in Germany in a case where Heiner Müller was sued for copyright infringement because he used a very big part of a piece by Brecht in his works, and he was sued by Brecht heirs. And he couldn't use the quotation exception because he used very, very big parts. So he was finally acquitted. It was finally not found guilty of copyright infringement because of the freedom of the art. The judge, it was the Supreme Court, the Constitutional Court in Germany, that says that it was a disproportionate limitation of his freedom of art. But in other countries, it's very difficult to argue. Many judges said, like in Belgium, they said, freedom of expression has no place to play in, no role to play in copyright law, because it's already taken into account by the exception. So outside of the copyright exception, freedom of expression shouldn't be invoked. Right? For me, it's completely crazy to say that. There is also an advantage of this defense, is that the freedom of the art is a defense, it's a freedom that is enjoyed both by the artist, by the creator, but also by the museum or the gallerist that who exhibits the works of the artist. So it's very interesting, because when a gallery is sued for copyright infringement, the gallery can also use that defense. So it's very, for me, I think it's very interesting. And to conclude, I would say that maybe I depicted to you a view of copyright law that is very welcoming to art appropriation. And it's true that I'm a bit naive in that image, because it's not like that. It's not the way it is right now, but it's the way I like it to be in the years to come. And for that, I think we have to deploy together some strategy to achieve that goal. And this strategy should be deployed on the artistic level, like you do, like most of you do, by using some works and by also not feeling threatened by copyright suit, because we need to have some case in the law, I think. So maybe you should play the victims. And I think also it's very important on a political field to be able to lobby the government to explain, but what is this copyright regime that plays against us, the artists? It's completely crazy. So I know we will hear from Canada about this strategy, and I think it's very, very interesting what they are doing there. And on the legal field, and that is for me, so I will work a bit also, I think that we should really, as lawyers, to deal with that issue, to write legal arguments about artistic appropriation, so that we can prepare some arguments for the cases where they will be coming in court. So I don't know. I hope I was maybe a bit optimistic, enthusiastic, but it's just to counterbalance what we will hear.
Michael wants to make a remark.
The Constitutional Court. And the most interesting thing in my eyes in this sentence was that the judges said that as soon as a piece of art comes into the public, it has to be a referential in a certain way. And it even goes over the step that the quotated, the big material, has to be self-referential in this context. So you can just use it as long as you create something new. And this is a really big step, I think, the whole copyright discussion.
I have a question to Severin. I have a quote here by Lawrence Lessig, and I would like to get your comment on this. In his book, Free Culture, he writes, I quote, "Fair use in America simply means the right to hire a lawyer to defend your right to create. And as lawyers tend to forget, our system for defining rights such as fair use is astonishingly bad in practically every context, but especially here. It costs too much, it delivers too slowly, and what it delivers often is too little to the justice underlying the claim. The legal system may be tolerable for the rich. Everyone else is an embarrassment to a tradition that proves itself on the rule of law." End of quote.
I would agree with him on some point, and I disagree with him on other point. It's true that the legal system is costly. It's even costly. It's even more costly in the United States. In Europe, it doesn't cost as much than in the United States. So it's possible to go in a court and to win a case. It will cost money, of course, but not as much than in the United States. And the problem with... It's true that the problem with the fair use in the United States, because it's a sort of open definition of what is allowed, it says that, okay, you can do something where it doesn't harm the exploitation of the work. It's a very large exception. And because it's open, copyright owners always try to sue you because they said, no, you're not in the definition, and you will need a judge to confirm if you are in or outside of the exception. Mm-hmm. In Europe, we have a list of exceptions. In the list, you have some conditions. So you know more or less, okay, it's always open for interpretation, but you know more or less if you are in or out. And so it solves a lot of issue, because when you are doing something that is clearly in an exception, then you can at least, you don't have to go in front of a court. You can convince the copyright owners that they might lose in courts. But it's true that we don't know in Europe an exception that say artistic appropriation is an exception. So we have to deal with the existing exceptions to see whether we are in or out. And this is the issue. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's also better to try to convince the governments that we need a new exception for artistic appropriation. But we've just changed in all countries in the European Union the system of exceptions, and I don't feel that it's the right moment to ask for a new exception. I don't think it's possible. So.
Thank you, Severin, for your very interesting contribution. So our next speaker will be Gordon Duggan, and he represents the artists that Severin wants to see, artists that take an activist approach to art and copyright question. He's one of the artists who get organized to work on building a lobby for artists' interest. Gordon is an artist and a filmmaker, and he made a really long trip to join us here in Berlin. He's living on Denman Island in British Columbia in Canada. Gordon is the co-founder of the Canadian-based copyright advocacy group called Appropriation Art, a coalition of art professionals. And since the beginning of June of this year, the coalition has grown to over 600 art professionals and artist groups from across Canada. The coalition seeks balanced copyright for all artists and is a strong advocate of free speech. The coalition has requested an urgent meeting with the Canadian government regarding the future of copyright legislation, And I would like to ask Gordon to tell us more about his activities. Do you need this?
Hello, can you hear? It's a very low microphone for me. I'm just going to run through kind of a history of what we're doing and discuss our strategy and go into a little bit of what's different between Canadian and American law. I think one of the things that makes what we're doing kind of interesting is that the overwhelming influence in the direction that copyright law is going, I think, is American copyright law. And in Canada, we're very much in the front lines of that. We're right next to them, for one thing, and we have a massive cultural deficit, which I'll talk about later. That's our website. Our coalition has only been in existence for about 4 months. We've got over 600 signatories, which includes 31 collectives and associations, 323 artists, 19 filmmakers, 139 gallery directors and presidents of art galleries, 33 curators, 73 public galleries, 56 educators, 29 colleges and universities, and in total we represent thousands of members. The artists we have, we really try and play up the fact that we have 3 artists that represented Canada and Venice, 8 Governor General Award winners, which is the highest honor that an artist can have in Canada, issued by the government. Bell Canada Award is a big cash money award. Several Royal Academy members, and what we are not, and this, we are not pirates, we're not kids. The part of what we're trying to do here that's, I think, slightly a different strategy is we're trying to play ourselves up as being part of the establishment. A lot of what we've achieved has happened partly through good luck, partly through good timing, and partly through hard work. We have the associations we have are CAMDA, the Canadian Art Museums Directors Association, CMA, the Canadian Museums Association, IMAA, the Independent Media Arts Association. And between those 3 associations, we represent every single public art gallery, museum, and artist-run center in Canada. So that gives us quite a bit of clout, if that's a word anyone knows. And we also have a strategy that says quite simply, appropriation art is legitimate art, period. So it's not open for discussion in our mind. It's in virtually every public collection in the world. It's in every art book in the world. There's just nothing to discuss there. The legitimacy of the work is well established. So for us, the issue isn't whether the art is legitimate. We don't take the discussion there on any level. As far as we're concerned, that's it. The issue for us is if it's legitimate and copyright is meant to protect legitimate work, then why isn't copyright protecting it? Why is it hindering it? So Sarah and I were actually moved to this remote place from London, and Sarah is my partner and the co-founder of it. And we moved to Canada to start making our own work again, and we realized that the law was not going to support the kind of work that we do. We actually appropriate whole Hollywood films, which is quite problematic. sometimes several. So there were 3 factors that kind of came to us forming the coalition. One is an exhibition that we're curating in Canada called Redirect. One was that there happened to be an election, and the other was an organization called CPIC. So Redirect is an exhibition that's going to happen and it's entirely work that appropriates the Hollywood cinema. It's all video artwork and it all appropriates Hollywood cinema. It's going to be in a city called Calgary, which is a city of about 1 million people, in September of next year. It's going to happen concurrently in 12 museums and galleries. It will have in excess of, we think, in excess of 80 works by 50 artists internationally. So it's a massive kind of thing. And it involves every art gallery and museum in the city, including commercial galleries. So what we found ourselves with was this very bold public statement by an entire city that this work is, that kind of reinforces the idea that the work is legitimate. The second strange kind of thing that came along for us that was very good was an election, and we got a conservative government, which in theory should be very bad. But what was happening at the time was they were about to pass, the Liberal government at the time was about to put through some not very good legislation concerning copyright. So what the change of government meant was that everything had to start over again. This gave us an opportunity. The other thing that happened was that the government is a minority government. In Canada, we have four primary parties. And the elected government only holds 40% of the seats. That makes them a fairly weak government. So they don't have the authority to push through legislation necessarily that they want to. They have to work with other parties. So these two factors came together to give us the opportunity not to wait until the new law was passed, but to actually kind of step in at the drafting point of the law. So we have the opportunity to have a voice in how the law is written rather than waiting until the law is written and passed and then fighting against it, which is a very fortunate thing for us. The third factor that came up was CPIC, which is the Canadian Internet. Which is the Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic, which is a group of lawyers from the University of Ottawa who fight for the public domain. And they offered us all the pro bono legal advice that we could need, which is basically giving us three or four lawyers to help us sort out any legal issues, help us draft our petitions to the government. They also are very well connected in Ottawa, and they can give us heads up to what's happening in terms of legislative changes, in terms of what's happening with the ministers, what the mood is, who's meeting with the ministers through the Freedom of Information Act. We can find out if they've been meeting with the recording industry behind our backs or other artist groups. And they also give us a huge amount of moral support. So those are the sort of factors that led to us forming this coalition. And it's all happened very quickly. We knew that through CPIC that at the time we were starting to form the coalition, that they were about to start drafting the new legislation. And we had a three-week window to go from nothing to forming the coalition. So in that three-week period, we originally thought we would come up and use the galleries in Calgary and say, here's a whole city. That's where it started from. But institutions being institutions, it's easy to get them to sign on to the show, but to sign their name to a letter to the government turned out to be a little more difficult to go through board members who didn't like it and didn't want it, check with legal advisors who didn't think it was a good idea, etc. So we decided we would put it out to the artists and figured we'd have 20 or 30 artists at least send a letter to the government and say, we're here and we want to have a voice. And we suddenly found ourselves getting 150 signatures a day at the end. And fortunately, someone in CAMDO, one of the art museum directors, got the letter forwarded to him 3 days before they were having their annual meeting. And he put it on the agenda for their meeting. They discussed it and decided that they needed to sign on to it. And CMA followed, and IMAA signed on independently. So this sort of all happened extremely fast. I mean, we didn't really know what we were doing. We came, like I said, we went from being artists in 3 weeks to being one of the biggest advocacy groups for arts in Canada in 3 weeks. So we've been playing catch up a lot. So we'll leave that now, and I'll talk a little bit about the difference between Canada and the USA, because, like I said, we're particularly influenced by American copyright law. One of the crucial things is that the American Constitution which is the equivalent of the rights here, fundamental rights, actually has copyright in it as a fundamental right. And it is there explicitly to promote the progress of science and useful arts and for a limited time. In Canada, it's not there. There's no in Canada, we also have no explicit mention of the public domain. So it doesn't actually exist in Canadian law. So although we have rights, there's no mention of public rights. I should stop doing that. In the USA, copyright and freedom of speech are both constitutional rights. This means that if someone violates your copyright, your freedom of expression is weighted more or less the same as the copyright violation. So when they go into a head-to-head battle, it's not so clear who should win, and more often than not, the copyright will win. In Canada, freedom of expression, like it is here, it is a fundamental right. Copyright is a statutory right. So when they come head-to-head, we should theoretically win. We also in Canada have a massive cultural deficit. I won't go into it in huge detail, but basically we run in a $2 billion a year cultural deficit with the United States. We're not that big a country, so that's quite a bit of money. $4 out of $5 collected through copyright goes straight to the United States. 95% of the Canadian box office for movies goes straight to the United States. And that's just kind of the start of it. And the music industry is equally bad. Sony was just speaking in front of the copyright board, I think yesterday, trying to explain why they produced 3 Canadian bands last year. Fighting to have stronger control over the Canadian recording industry. Other things that are quite different in Canadian law, there was a case called CCH versus Canadian Law Society, which had to do with lawyers making photocopies. But in the judgment for that case, the Supreme Court made explicit reference to user rights, which is the first time, as I said. User rights and the public domain are not explicitly mentioned anywhere in Canadian rights. And they put user rights as being central to copyright law. And it's important to understand that what they've described it is that fair dealing is not an exception. 1 minute? Okay, I'll start going quicker. Fair dealing in Canada is not an exception now because of this ruling, but it's seen as a right. So that puts fair dealing on an equal basis with copyright. So these arguments about how much of a work you can use and things become quite different. Moving along. This is just stuff to do with the minority government, which I now have to speak through. But one of the things that we're doing is when we sent our letter, the Minister of Heritage, which is the Minister of Culture, refused to meet with us. So one of our strategies is to actually shame her into a meeting. Because again, the government is a minority government, what we're able to do is set up meetings with the opposition ministers. So we set up meetings with the NDP and the Bloc and the Liberals, and then we send her another letter that says, we're in town meeting with the Bloc, the Liberals, and the NDP. Do you have time? And they're making time. The coalition has 3 principles, which are fair access, which is just to say that as appropriation artists doing legitimate art, we need to have access to work. That the rights of the quote creators have to be balanced against the rights of the users. And what we want is certainty of access. We want it to be very clear that we have that right, that we don't have to go to court every time someone appropriates something and fight it out in court. Another important piece of case law that came out in Canada was that originality or authorship in Canadian works is now seen as being a relationship between the person who creates the new work and that work, independent of its relationship to other works. So that is another kind of benefit that we have. We're also going out against DRMs, digital locks, things like that, on the basis that even if we have the right to access something, we need to have the access to it. Particularly in Canada, digital locks have the potential to wipe out Canadian culture, more or less. It'll eliminate copyright and it'll force us to deal with American content. Because we work in this huge cultural deficit in Canada, we also feel it's important that we're able to comment on work coming from the United States. That the idea of wholesale importing that much of a foreign culture into your country and not giving your cultural community the opportunity to Canadianize it, to make it their own, or to comment on differences between the two cultures, is essentially erasing your culture. So I think we can make strong arguments on that. So I'll just quickly run through our strategies. Our first strategy was that we would get the people from Calgary to sign the letter, and then we'd go back to making art. That was the original strategy. Our second strategy was that we open it up to artists, then get the meeting with the governments, then we'd hopefully change copyright law, and then we'd go back to making art. Our third strategy was to get the signatures, get the meeting with the opposition critics, force the meeting with the ministers. This is where we are now. Change Canadian copyright law or bring down the government. that sounds quite funny, but it's actually a possibility. The new government ran on an anti-corruption platform. The previous Minister of Culture lost her seat in the election because her campaign was almost entirely funded by the music and broadcast and film industries, who supported only one candidate, the Minister of Culture. So when it was clear that she was going to lose, they actually funded the new Minister of Culture almost entirely. So what we have is a Minister of Culture who's been more or less elected through contributions by the music and film industry. So what all the people on our side are doing is waiting to see what legislation she comes out with. And if we don't like it, then we'll try and bring down the government. Which in a minority government is actually a possibility because they've run on it. And then we'll go back after we've finished with that to making art. Our fourth strategy appears to be now we're going to go for the signatures, the meetings, force the meeting, change Canadian copyright law. And now we're thinking we may as well have a go at international law. And then hopefully we can go back to making some art. So that's it.
Very much, Gordon. So am I right? This is all voluntary work you're doing?
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like a real full-time job.
I suppose it's interesting to point out that this has happened within the last 4 months. The core of the coalition is Sarah Joyce, my partner, and I. We've done it with no funding, one computer, two people, and 4 months. So, although I have noticed that the Canadian government partially funded my coming here, so I can no longer say we have no funding. We have a little bit of funding.
Okay, and I have one last question to you, yeah. Which is, you certainly also have, I mean, you're kind of an artist initiative, at least, not to say organization, and there is certainly also one or several traditional artist organizations which usually take a very different approach to copyright law than you do. Are you in dialogue? Are you cooperating with this organization?
We're actually the major Canadian artist representation group called CARFAC, Canadian Artist Representation, have come up very, very strongly against us. And we're in a kind of press release war with them right now. You can read that exchange on our website. But their position is that we're weakening artists' rights, and our position is that we're artists, and it's their responsibility of their mandate to represent us, not to decide what art they should represent and shouldn't. It's art, we're artists, they're supposed to represent us. So we're in a bit of a battle there. The artist representation group and all of the associated groups, the music publishers, the music industry, are all having a conference like this in about a week or a week and a half in Canada, and we're the only ones from this side invited. So I think they're going to try and crucify us at this, but we're ready for it, I think.
Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot, Gordon. So far the panel was very much towards the aspect of accessibility of information and of artworks and material. This is certainly an important issue for artists, but the work of Simon Yule, which is our next speaker, adds another dimension to it, I would say. Simon Yule is an artist and a programmer, and he's living and working in Glasgow in Scotland. He's doing software-based art project, working with free open source software, and he's interested in various forms of autonomous social practices and non-institutional knowledge systems. I think he will speak about one of his recent projects is Spring Alpha, a gaming project, and I hand over the microphone to Simon.
Thanks. I'm not going to talk about my own work now. I'm going to talk about some broader things. The main thing I'm going to talk about is an idea that I've been calling distributive practice, which is just a kind of loose idea I've been using to kind of think through the relationship between artistic practice and copyleft, and therefore relates to these broader discussions about what is free culture, which is one of the things we were discussing yesterday, in which Nicholas was summarizing at the start. And which I guess is one of the kind of sub-themes of this year's WAS. So discussions of copyright and copyleft often focus on art as a set of objects, as commodities, rather than art as a series of practices. And I think also, to a large extent, the legal approach to art is also defined in terms of art as artifacts and the relationships of property, the author as an owner of a particular artifact and such. But my interest in artistic practice, I think art in itself is more significant in its social sense when it's seen in terms of practices rather than objects, and to shift the thinking to thinking about practices rather than objects. Maybe we're a different way of looking at this kind of issues that are the things we've been discussing here. Thinking in terms of art as a practice reintroduces and emphasizes the links of art and ethics, of aesthetics and ethics, and also poesis and praxis. So distributive practice is a way of thinking through the relationship between art and copyleft in terms of practice rather than object or resource. And it's also a way of dealing with this whole issue about openness and freedom, that we find, and the kind of problematics of this. That's why I don't use that either of those terms in naming it. This also relates to the kind of distinction that exists between free software and open source, or at least within the rhetorics around free software and open source as they kind of stabilized within the discourses around them. Open source emphasizes the utility factor of access, the usefulness of handling code as a resource, and as such has been recuperated very easily into commercial production systems. And following from that, the notion of open culture and the rhetoric of open culture has been very quickly recuperated into commercial media, such as has become to be known as Web 2.0, and all kind of MySpace, Flickr, and this kind of long-tail commerce that's a topic of other discussions in this conference. Free software, however, promotes a particular practice, an ethos of how code can be produced and how programmers work. And yesterday, one of the things that Felix Stalder was talking about, and I believe he brought up this morning here too, or this afternoon, was this idea of using a license to declare a particular ethos. And I think that's one of the main drives behind free software. And one of the ways in which free software programmers often differentiate themselves from open source programmers. So access to code is a means to this rather than an end in itself. And there's a statement in the preamble to the GPL which kind of emphasizes a little statement says, so you know that you may do these things, which kind of emphasizes this idea of the practice, of getting access to a practice, a way of doing things, rather than just the code as a resource. And this way, the GPL is promoting a particular praxis rather than stabilizing on the utility of access as open source code does. So it's not just the code itself which is distributed through a kind of free software project and through the inclusion of the GPL. It's an attempt to also distribute a particular praxis, a particular kind of practice of coding. So the practice is distributed within the work. More broadly then, a distributive practice is one in which the transmission of this practice of production is integral to the way in which others engage and experience with that artwork once it leaves the author. So the practice doesn't stay with the author, but is contained or referenced or exposed within it in a way that enables that to be manifest by those who receive it and carry it on. So I've been looking at some different examples of this, what I think relates to this idea is partly a way of thinking it through, and also possibly providing a kind of set of models to think through the idea of free culture that's not entirely dependent upon the models of the free software movement, but things that come from elsewhere, from within artistic practices of other times that we can possibly draw upon in articulating these ideas. One is the work of Christopher Alexander as an architect. There's the direct relation between Alexander's architectural work or his architectural concepts and forms of free open source software development in terms of this concept known as design patterns, which those of you who are programmers may be familiar with, which is a way of defining how to go about solving particular programming projects or particular programming problems. This concept of design patterns derives from the work of Christopher Alexander. And it has probably quite a strong link to the whole idea of open cultures, because the wiki, which in many senses is the tool which epitomizes the idea of open culture to many people, or free culture to many people. The first wiki, the Portland Pattern Repository, was developed as a space in which to archive and discuss design patterns. So this is a practice from outside programming which has a direct relationship to kind of current free open source practice. There is a significant distinction, however, between the way in which design patterns have been used within programming and the way in which Alexander intended them. And it's similar to this distinction I've already made between free software and open source. Design patterns within programming largely focus upon purely social, purely formal issues, and in a sense are a purely pragmatic tool. For Alexander, however, they were a social issue as well. They were an ethical issue. It was about, for him, rethinking the relationship of how spaces are built and designed and taking it away from the institution of the architect as a master author and enabling those who dwell within cities to also be part of the authorship process. So there's an analogy to the kind of user-developer relationship between programmers and users in FLOSS. For Alexander, it's carried beyond the simple pragmatics of how the shape of buildings and the look and things of things to also thinking about the social relationships within a particular city. So this, for example, is one example of a design pattern, which is rethinking about the idea of schooling and taking school away from the idea of a centralized resource to think of a kind of distributed resource throughout the city and how that resource might be then utilized by the citizens of the city. In his writings on design patterns, he talks about the design pattern as providing a solution that is stated in such a way that it gives the essential field of relationships needed to solve the problem, but in a very general way, so that you can solve the problem for yourself in your own way by adapting it to your preferences and the local conditions at the place where you are making it. So in this sense, it's about the design patterns are a means of distributing practices of architectural design in a way that can be localized and reassembled by people in their own contexts. So it shifts authorship away from the singular architect to the community. From a very different context, the free jazz movement has emerged in the kind of 60s in the States, attempted to kind of form different forms of exploring how jazz music was produced. This is largely, you think of it nowadays, as just being a kind of formal experimentation with the idea of improvisation. But there were particular groups within the free jazz movement, and such as the Black Arts Group of St. Louis, who's the group in the picture, who went beyond that, beyond the idea of seeing it just as formal experimentation, and as being about a rethinking of the relationship between how music was produced and who are the people that produce it. In some sense, the free and the free jazz that the Black Arts Group promote has some analogies with the free in terms of the free software movement. For the Black Arts Group, this, who operated primarily from 1968 to 1973, one of the key elements in achieving this was setting up a kind of social center in St. Louis where they operated from, and using that as a space not just for rehearsal for themselves, but creating it as a kind of public platform. They ran workshops in there to teach people jazz, but also a whole range of other skills, often outside of art practice as well. It was to provide education that wasn't given to the local community, and it was providing that education directly within that community as well. Also, this provided a space in which people could be involved in participation in the creation of works that were later performed by the group and local participants, but also provided a space for social discussion and debate and political discussion, which again did not exist within the area. So it's a kind of precursor to some extent to kind of modern day hack lab, in the way certain hack labs, such as the ones in Barcelona and Italy, operate. And this went on to also look at how the work is distributed. So they involved, for example, setting up their own record label, and this was one of the first black-run record labels promoting contemporary jazz music in the States. And as a way of shifting the control of distribution away from the kind of mainstream corporations, it's also extended to the venues where stuff was performed, which again, back in the 60s, was very much a kind of controlled network of established jazz venues where people were expected to perform in order to build a career as a jazz musician. They operated outside of that, places like churches, shops, community centers and such, and deliberately chose to operate in those spaces in order to engage with different audiences. So the products, the kind of output of groups like the Black Art Group, were intended not just as statements of their own expression. In fact, they sought to, there was a conscious idea of shifting away from the idea of a singular offer. They saw that as integral to the notion of a modern jazz ethos, and shifted it so that the works became a means of distributing and transferring the practices to the audiences and communities that they engaged with, therefore kind of breaking down the author-producer relationship. Oh, okay, I'll talk past it. Operating around the same time in London was a group called the Scratch Orchestra, who was again set up by a group of free jazz musicians called the AMM. The Scratch Orchestra was a kind of improvisational group which was open in membership to anybody who wished to join. And the membership was a mixture of musicians and non-musicians. One of the key practices of the Scratch Orchestra were things known as scratch music, and this image is an example of the scratch music score. And these were kind of scores for improvisation that were developed by members of the Scratch Orchestra. And again, they're kind of an instance of a kind of free software open source model. They were consciously distributed and exchanged between members. They were made public domain. It was a conscious act of making every score a public domain artifact rather than retaining copyright over it. And they were a means not only of constructing performances by assembling different scores together, in the same way that you could assemble different libraries together to make a piece of software, different scores would be assembled to produce a performance. They also provided a kind of tool for which to enable critique and discussion of the orchestra's practice. One of the members of the Scratch Orchestra was an artist called Stefan Schakelken, who later went on to be very instrumental in kind of artists' self-distribution and self-publishing works in the kind of 80s in Britain. Britain was involved with the Workers' Press and Exploding Cinema Group in London, from which a lot of the British net art grew out of in many respects. People like Matthew Fuller and Graham Hard were involved in this. And one of Stefan's earlier projects was the Survival Scrapbooks, which is, again, an image here, which was just almost immediately after the breakup of the Scratch Orchestra in the early 70s. And these are a collection of how-to guides covering a whole range of different aspects, from alternative living systems to energy systems, food systems and such. They were produced as a collection, as books, which had punch hole bindings in them rather than kind of sealed books. The idea that you could take the book apart, reassemble it in different ways, introduce new content into it, and photocopy it and distribute it. So the artifact itself was consciously intended to be a distributive medium. And what it distributes is models of different types of practice, different types of social practice or technological practice. So more recently, I've been involved in this project in Glasgow called the Glasgow User Manual, which, well, it's not directly deriving from any of these examples, and somehow has kind of rediscovered some of the principles initiated by a Glasgow artist called Bob Hamilton. And this takes the form of a series of workshops and how-to guides, which have been published online and collated online. And these are kind of a context within which to explore and draw upon non-institutionalized knowledge. So it's not brought from experts, it's not brought from traditional schooling models, but rather from people's own ideas, what grows up from kind of grassroots initiatives within the city. And the main kind of interest behind the Glasgow User Manual is to kind of reinvent the city through practices of everyday life and kind of rethinking and proposing different models of everyday life activity. And it presents the city as a kind of context of discursive practices, therefore. The Spring Alpha Project, which Cornelia mentioned as part of my contribution to this project. Here I would have shown you a website that the network stands. We'll do without images for it. Spring Alpha basically takes the practices of game design, code development, open source code development, as a practice for thinking through the construction of social rules and systems. And it uses the game engine as a device through which to construct and run, in a sense, speculative narratives that allow people to reflect and improvise upon these kind of social rules and systems which are postulated through the design of the game, and also enables them to be collated, documented, and distributed. So in a sense, there's an analogy to what was done with the Scratch Music scores. The code and concepts for the games become tools for debate and discussion. And it creates a space for debate rather than simply being a nice collaborative project. So none of these examples really highlight the whole idea of use and appropriation that we've been discussing so far. But what they do emphasize is the idea of authorship as a recombinant process. And I think this idea of recombination is something that's actually really crucial to what everyone's been talking about here. And forms of cultural production in which reuse and recombination are absolutely integral. The value of recombination, and the value in the sense of openness, of freedom, or distributiveness, is not, I think, simply one of creating collaborative frameworks, which is where the use of free software within art is often posited, but rather it's for creating spaces of discussion, debate, of disagreement, even. And the ability to reuse and reoffer is absolutely essential to that. So in a sense, the ethics of appropriation, of appropriative and recombinant art, are necessary kind of ethics of debate and of discourse. And to deprive those possibilities is to deprive that potential of the artistic work. So if we're looking to define kind of notions of free culture, I'd argue that kind of a principle of distributive practice is integral to that, and that we think less in terms of the exchange of artifacts and the openness of resources, and think more in terms of how to rather than what is, in terms of verbs and practices rather than nouns. And yesterday the phrase was brought up that we should think of free cultures as not just art, but I also argue we should think of it as not just collaboration, and move beyond the simple ideas of openness as a kind of attractive thing in its own right, and look at the practices which enabled through that. And that's where the significance of a kind of possible free culture movement, I think, will lie. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Simon. May I ask you a question? So you were making, unfortunately we couldn't see any of your work, I would have loved to. You were making an emphasis on distributiveness and building spaces and ethics within your artistic practice. And it's a simple question, but it will be difficult to answer probably, but still it also takes up a discussion we had yesterday about tools and aesthetics. I would like to ask you to draw a line also to the aesthetics from these qualities of distributiveness, the ethics you mentioned, to your practice as an artist, which has also something to do with aesthetics, I guess.
I guess the key thing is it's an aesthetics which can include disagreement within how
you
engage
with
it.
Microphone?
I think the key thing is it's an aesthetics that can include disagreement and debate within it. And of transferring authorship as a way of facilitating that rather than simply the idea of collaboration as an end in its own right.
Okay. So we have, we have 10 minutes left. When do you have to leave? Severin has to catch a plane at 7?
7 and 10.
Okay, so you have 10 minutes left. We can see how we can create a discussion with all these different approaches. One thing I'm wondering is if this cases, problems we have brought up, how much is this fictional actually? Because if you look it up, there's almost no cases in court about this. And I think Severin can tell us more about it. Where does this problem actually take place? It doesn't go to the court. This is also an argument of many people saying, what are you talking about? We don't have any legal, we have no lawsuits, there is no problem. Where does it take place? Where is the location?
This is really a false argument. It's true that I heard that quite often. They said, but there is no problem because there is no litigation. We don't know any courts in Europe. We have, I don't know, about appropriation hard. There should be 2-3 cases in the United States and 5 cases in the whole Europe, as far as I know, so it's not much. But most of the cases don't happen in courts. A lot of artists, a lot of galleries received some letters from copyright owners saying you can't do that, and they just stop, they don't go to courts, or even some curators, and you know something about it, will just say we can't take the risk, so they auto censor themselves. They self censor themselves, mm-hmm. because they are afraid, even if they might never receive any letter from copyright lawyers, but they're just too afraid of taking the chance. So there are a lot of things going on outside of the courts, and also the artists should maybe put together all the experience they had to really say, those are all the cases that were not brought in court because we felt threatened and we mm-hmm. didn't take the chance to go further.
There are threats about $100,000 to up to $2 or $3 million when you cannot face the single artist by the major industry. And I would really love to have a court case, actually, to fight this out once, because then things are much clearer. Right now, it's kind of this gray zone, and nobody wants to move because he cannot afford it. But if there's some kind of initiative, maybe by some lawyers who are supporting artists in this matter, and maybe a couple of lawyers, a couple of artists fighting this through, then there might be a chance to get things clear. I mean, I agree with you, there's not really a problem.
Maybe Gordon also wants to add.
Simply because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean it's not imminent. I mean, there are examples of outside the courts of things being settled in Canada. John Oswald, the same year he won the Governor General's Award, was forced to destroy the work, the Plunderponics work that he got the award for. by Sony. I think it was Sony and Michael Jackson. And what's that? Oh, come on.
Anyway, so, but,
we also know that, you know, if you look at downloading, probably 6 years ago, 7 years ago, there were no cases of that. And I think the RIAA just topped 27,000 cases of suing fans for downloading in the States. So, you know, we live in, you know, and I think last week in Britain, Disney sued a mother for trying to have Winnie the Pooh carved into the headstone of her dead child. So, you know, ethically, we know how they were, right? The fact that they haven't gone after us yet is luck or chance, or they just haven't figured out we're there. You know, like I said, they'll go after a mother for putting a cartoon character on her dead child's headstone. Artists aren't likely to be safe.
So I think that not many cases go to court. The reason for that is that artists are frightened of taking the risk. So it would not be like for your initiative the next step to provide some kind of support structure or at least a context for this kind of cases, so that when an artist comes into a situation, knows that I'm not by myself, yeah, can rely on a system that's
all the support
going to...
in the world isn't going to pay your legal bills. Now, what we have is we have the lawyers at the clinic, and we've just had a case lawyer contact us and say that he's willing to work with us. However, going to court is very expensive, so we need to. We are trying to find more lawyers to work with us. The funding for CPIC comes actually through law firms across Canada offering pro bono time, and then they get matching funds against that. So there are a group of lawyers in the background supporting us, although not in court, because nothing's come to court. There's a case of sort of an art video film piece made up in Winnipeg out of footage of hockey games that they were phoned by a TV station, that the archivist at a TV station saying, we've just thrown out tons of this footage. They've thrown it out. They have no use for it. You guys should go over and get it. They did. They made a documentary film. And now the television station is suing them for copyright infringement. They're looking at it very seriously. They've asked them to destroy the work. They've refused to. And that particular case is starting to escalate now. I'm not sure the status of it at the moment, but it's imminent. Mm. I mean, like I said, just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it won't. And our exhibition in Calgary will be a very kind of...
When is it going to
quite a big
place?
Announcement that the work is there.
When is it?
September of next year.
Okay. So, Christian?
The worst thing about all this is that artists tend to self-censor themselves, and one can see a history of self-censorship in the 20th century. People, artists referring to other pieces of art, take pieces of art that where copyright problematics is expired by the artist they are referring to being dead for 50 or 70 years. That changed in the last decades. There are many examples in music and in art. So the task I think we have is to make clear, especially what you said, making clear what is Canadian culture compared to this overload of American culture. That needs to be something that is a contemporary thought, and it has to deal with contemporary content. Otherwise, that doesn't make sense. If you would refer to the beginnings of American filmmaking in the beginning of the 20th century, people would not understand your point. So you have to take probably things that are... might not even be published, that you find on the net, so you make yourself be followed by copyright infringement on two sides. First you use something that's not even on the market, and then you use something that has the copyright stamp on it very heavily. So on one hand, one has to refer to things that are very well known to make things clear. On the other hand, you have to refer to things that are very contemporary and very new. And that's both a big problem. And we should not censor ourselves. That's, I think, something we have to agree on to, and we have to be sort of strong together.
Okay, this has to be the word to end with, which is not so bad, I think. You can look forward to our manifesto of the open questions. And thanks for coming.